I call this meeting of the Human Services, Finance and Policy Combined to order. Good afternoon, everyone. Members, please have a seat. I think the Vice Chair, you're sitting right in front. Welcome, members and also members of the public. I'm excited that we're getting started with the Human Services Finance, but we also have the policy because it's a combined effort to get through the finances of human services. With that, I just wanted to start with introductions quickly, and I will start with myself, and we'll go from my side on the right, and then we'll come back on the other side. So, Mahmoud Noor, I'm the chair for Human Services. I represent District 60B in Minneapolis.
I represent Peter Fisher, House District 44A, and I chair the Human Services Policy.
Representative Kristen Bonner, I serve as the Vice Chair for the Human Services Finance.
Don Gilman, I represent District 17A, and I'm on Human Services Finance.
Duane Quam.
Andrew Ridley.
Paul Devadney.
Deb Keel.
Elliot Engen, representing District 36A.
Representative Liz Ryer, 52A, Egan and Burnsville.
Representative Dave Baker, Kanawha County, straight west of here. Thank you.
Representative Carly Katiza Watoon, 49B, Eden Prairie.
Heather Edelson, I'm on policy, and Edina Bloomington.
Representative Jess Hansen, Savage and Burnsville, 55A, and I'm on policy and children and families.
Representative Heather Keeler, District 4A, on children and family and finance.
Representative Mary Frances Clardy, 53A, Mendota Heights, Sunfish Lake, Lilydale, Invergrove Heights, and West St. Paul.
Kim Hicks, 25A, Rochester, and I'm on Human Services Policy and Finance.
Representative Lee Finke, I represent District 66A in St. Paul, Roseville, Falcon Heights, Lauderdale. I'm on policy, and my pronouns are she, her.
Lori Pryor, Eden Prairie and Minnetonka, and I'm on finance.
Representative Breon Curran from 36B, I am on the Human Services Policy Committee. My pronouns are she, her.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sebastian. I am the committee legislative assistant. I'm proud to be here.
I'm Sean Herring. I'm the committee administrator.
We have Representative Franson.
Yes, thank you, Representative Franson, District 12B, a good chunk of Douglas County, a portion of Polk County, and a portion of Stearns County.
Now we'll shift to the partisan staff.
Joe Durheim, DFL Caucus Research for Finance.
CNA.
Jonathan Cotter, GOP Research for the HHS Committees.
If I can get on the left side, we have the CAs and other non-
Nick Skimmelanger, the Community Administrator for the Human Services Policy Committee.
Jared Margolis, I'm the Committee Legislative Assistant for Human Services Policy.
That's gross. Research.
And to the most important group, we'll go from, starting with Doug. Doug, so.
Hi, I'm Doug Berg. I'm a fiscal analyst, and I cover primarily the accounts in Representative Noor's committee and Representative Pinto's committee.
Joe Harney, House Fiscal. I cover the remaining accounts in Representative Liebling's committee.
We have the House Research.
I'm Sarah Sunderman from Nonpartisan House Research. I cover behavioral health and child protection and various other human services topics.
Danielle Pinelli from House Research, Nonpartisan Staff, and I cover long-term care, income assistance programs, and homelessness programs.
And The last but not the least, we have Representative Zielinska. If you can introduce yourself to the
Sorry, I got tied up in another meeting. I'm Representative Zielinska from District 3B. Nice to meet you.
Welcome. And without, you know, forgetting the pages, I from the right side.
Yeah, I'm Nick Samer.
We have one today, so hopefully we'll get two who are going to help us move things around. Just also wanted to acknowledge the ranking members here. We have got Representative New Brindley, who is the ranking member for the GOP in the House of Finance. Representative Fisher, anything else?
I'd also like to recognize Representative Keel, who is the lead, Republican lead on the Human Services Policy, and we thank you for the opportunity to be able to do the joint meeting here today.
Without further ado, we'll start with the Human Service Finance team.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, I'm Doug Berg. I'm a fiscal analyst. My colleague, Mr. Harney, and I are going to start with some very high-level overview of jurisdiction and finance in this committee, and then the House research folks will follow up with more detail. I'm going to move pretty fast. We are through this, but the first slide I will take just a bit of time on, since there's been it's been some time getting it sorted out what the jurisdictions are, and so I'll take just a second to go through it. I think as of yesterday afternoon, we're pretty well set. If you go to the far left-hand column, you'll see these are categorized. The DHS groupings are the central office with its various parts, which are now in Representative Liebling's committee. In forecasted programs, the first two, Minnesota MFIP and MFIP Child Care, are in the Children and Families. General Assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, and Housing Support are in Representative Liebling's committee, the Health Committee. Medical Assistance is split between this committee and the Health Committee. This committee has jurisdiction over long-term care, elderly and disabled, and long-term care waivers. And the Health Committee has the acute care programs, families with children basic and adults and kids without kids. This committee also has the alternative care program and the behavioral health fund, and then children and families will have North Star Care for Children, the adoption program. That takes care of the forecasted program. All of direct care and treatment at DHS is in this committee, the Human Services Committee. The grant programs in the middle table, the first six all the way down through children and economic support grants are in children and families. This committee has health care grants. The health committee has other long-term care grants. And then this committee has the rest of the grants list. And then in the far right column, all of the health department is in the health committee along with the Emergency Medical Services Board. This committee has the Council on Disability and the Ombudsman Person for Mental Health Developmental Disabilities. And then the three lower ombudspersons are in the Children and Families Committee. And then MNSURE is in the Health Committee. I will just note it has the general fund expenditure for 22-23 for these programs, which is a total you'll see at the top and on the bottom of $15.2 billion. That's general fund only. It's substantially higher when you add other funds, as you'll see in a minute. And there is one error on here I'll point out. The MNSURE has not got a number for expenditure. They did receive $17.1 million in general fund expenditures transfers in this biennium. That's entirely related to holding them harmless from the effects of reinsurance. They do not have a regular general fund appropriation, but they did receive $17 million in the current biennium. Moving on. Just to give you some scope, the entire waterfront of what I mentioned there, if you look at it as a share of the general fund, this chart looks at that over 35 years. And you can see that as a general trend, human services has been taking up a greater share of the general fund budget over time. But there is some variation. It's not every year up. And I did put in the 24-25 base. In addition, you see that The current biennium actually went down some, but that is, I think, an artifact of primarily the pandemic, where some of our programs, I'd single out the MFIP child care and some others as well, have had reduced pressure on them. But as of next biennium, the base takes up 32.6% of general fund expenditures. And I'll let Mr. Harney go with the next.
Before, there's a question from a member for Mr. Burke. Go ahead, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we have so many new members and this chart is fairly complex, if a soft copy could be sent and then have a character that you could put for, you know, we've got three committees. So what you can do is have a character for each committee or symbol and put it next to the line item, and it and some of the line items will have more than one character, and that way it'll help the members to be able to understand, and it'd be a good resource. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for
being Mr. Chair, there will be, I anticipate the Chief Fiscal Analyst putting out a committee jurisdiction list for accounts now that that's settled in the next day or two, but we can also highlight it on the first chart here and pass it out to all three committees.
Where the slide Mr. Berg showed before this one shows the HHH share of total general fund across state government, this slide breaks down the net expenditures by fund from all HHS agencies. A majority of net expenditures come from the general fund and federal funds, but there's a mix of many other funding sources available to the legislature and agencies for financing their activities. I'll highlight one of them being the Healthcare Access Fund, and others being the special revenue and state government special revenue funds that touch on the health-related licensing boards and their licensing activities. So to that end, these next four slides will show the net base expenditures for all HHS agencies. This includes all the funds I just talked about on the previous slide. The goal here is going to illustrate the relative scale HHS finance committees deal with when making budgetary decisions. This committee doesn't have jurisdiction over the agencies and entities listed here, but again, this is illustrative just to show you how we scale up when we add in the more bigger agencies. So right before you on this first slide, the health licensing boards. They're primarily financed by license revenue they generate, with a few exceptions, one of which Mr. Berg highlighted before, is the EMSRB receives a sizable general fund appropriation to the tune of $7.7 million. The second slide, again, this is all agencies, all funds, adds in MnSure to get a sense of the growing scale. MnSure is financed by the Qualified Health Plan premium withhold revenue. Like Mr. Berg said, very small amount of general fund dollars have touched MnSure since its inception. And it has a base expenditure in the plan, in the upcoming biennium of $71 million. When you add in the Department of Health, again, illustrating the scale here that grows, this third slide shows the $1.5 billion in planned expenditures in fiscal year 24-25 at the department. While, again, this isn't under this committee's jurisdiction, I see we have some members that were in health finance. You'll note and you'll remember that just 20% of this $1.5 billion is from the general fund. The remaining amount at the Department of Health is a mix of federal and other funds. And then last but not least, the fourth slide finally introduces for you all the Department of Human Services to the scaling-based expenditures I'm showing you. When considering all other Health and Human Services agencies with all other funds included, those agencies make up only approximately 3% of the $51 billion in spending that's planned at the Department of Human Services in the upcoming biennium. To go perhaps from a 30,000-foot view to a 20,000-foot view, this next chart shows you just general fund dollars at general fund agencies. So what's changed here is the amount. You'll remember my comment about the health licensing boards not being financed through general fund dollars. But what hasn't changed, of course, is the scale. What you still see here is a predominant amount of general fund dollars that HHS finance committees choose to spend at the Department of Human Services. The next part to frame this, to dig down a little bit further and not go too far in the weeds, is to frame this as medical assistance in the general fund versus all other programs and activities in the general fund. When you frame it this way, you still get a sense of scale that medical assistance is the major driver for majority decisions that finance committees in this area typically make. That's planned to be in the upcoming biennium, $13.7 billion going to medical assistance, and all other general fund at all other agencies for all other programs and activities only makes up only $3.5 billion. I'll pass it over to Mr. Berg to take us home here.
Ms. Stephanie, if you can
take
a break there. Do we have any question? I know this is a lot to take in, but it's just a more of an overview. We'll go over this slowly. No one has got a question. I just wanted to ask a quick question. What percentage is for the elderly and disabled when you look at the MA percentage?
Mr. Chair, we're going to get that in the next two slides. We're going to head right to that question. Okay. The next slide shows you the MA expenditures, general fund expenditures by eligibility category, and just the raw amount. And the eligibility categories, or subcodes as we refer to them, are the top one is children and families, basic care, which is about 3.1, almost 3.2 billion. Adults without kids, which is 638,000. And I'll just take a second to note here, those of you who are in the earlier hearing in Representative Fisher's, it was noted by DHS that the matching percentage we get from the federal government is different for adults without children. Under the ACA, the federal government pays 90% of the costs in adults without children, whereas the share is closer to 50-50. It's not exactly 50-50 now, but it's closer to that in the other categories. So the state only pays $638 million, almost $639 for adults without children. Elderly and disabled is about $4.5 million. Long-term care waivers, and there are five, elderly waiver, brain injury, CADI, CAC, and developmental DD waiver, developmentally disabled, is 5.7, almost 5.8 billion. And then long-term care facilities is 1.2 billion. And I think, Mr. Chair, the next chart, which the department also showed a version of in Representative Fisher's committee, is the one that I think you're getting at here. The top bar in each case here for each category of enrollment eligibility, the top bar, the dark bar, is enrollment percentage by that category, and the second bar, the lighter bar, is the percentage of expenditures. And what this tells you is if you look, children and families and adults without kids represent about 83.6% of the enrollment, the vast majority of the enrollment, but only about 40% of the expenditures. Whereas elderly and disabled and DD, or elderly and disabled, are only about 16.4% of the enrollment, but they represent 60% of the expenditures in Medicaid. And I think, and that's where Mr. Harney and I are going to leave it. If there are questions about the numbers.
Members, any questions for the fiscal staff? Seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. Berg and Mr. Haney, for your presentation. We'll be coming back to you many times, for sure. Ms. Mignelli and Ms. Sandham. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, Danielle Pennelly from the House Research Department again. I am going to start with an overview of some of the programs that are under the jurisdiction of Health and Human Services and specifically these two committees. So first, I'll talk a little bit about the health care and human services programs more generally on this slide. The Department of Human Services is the primary executive branch agency that oversees human services programs. DHS supervises program administration, ensures compliance with federal requirements, makes rules, and provides training, program evaluation, and technical assistance to counties, while the counties administer programs, accepting applications, determining client eligibility, contracting with local service providers, and referring clients to services. The legislature enacts provisions that may go beyond minimum federal requirements for the programs where there's a federal component, but policies set by the legislature are often influenced by federal requirements that are prerequisites for receiving the federal funding. The first set of programs that we're going to go through are the long-term care programs. Long-term care programs and services for the elderly and disabled are available through the medical assistance program, which is the state's Medicaid program, state-funded programs, and also programs that are administered by the Board on Aging. This table shows for fiscal year 2022 various long-term care services that are provided under medical assistance and the monthly average recipients and then federal and state funding for those programs, just to get a sense of the size and cost of each program. So for medical assistance programs, persons that, who are eligible under the elderly or disabled categories have to meet income and asset standards that are lower than the standards for other eligibility categories. And then they also have to meet other eligibility requirements, such as citizenship and residency requirements. And to be eligible as an elderly person, a person must be age 65 or older, and to be eligible as a person with disabilities, an individual must satisfy the disability criteria that is used by the Federal Social Security Administration or the state medical review team. Nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled, the ICFDDs, are institutions. And all of the other things listed on this table are home care, home and community-based services. The home health care and PCA services typically need to be medically necessary, ordered by a licensed physician, documented in a written service plan, and provided in the person's residence or other community setting. And generally for all of these home and community-based services, in order to be able to receive a service, a person needs to be assessed as having the appropriate level of care need. The PCA services, personal care assistance services, are actually scheduled to be replaced by a new program called Community First Services and Supports, which is supposed to be phased in on a rolling basis over the course of, I think, 12 months. And the latest date that I've heard for that transition is no sooner than April 1st of this year. The alternative care program is a home and community-based program that provides services to individuals who are not yet eligible for MA but who are at risk of nursing home placement. This is a program that started out several years ago as a state-only funded program, but starting in 2014, we get federal Medicaid match for it now. And then the home and community-based waivers, there are five of those. There are four disability waivers, and then there's the elderly waiver. And each one provides services to a slightly different population of people who have different care needs. The community alternative care waiver provides services to people with chronic illnesses who need the level of care that's provided in a hospital. Then there's the Community Access for Disability Inclusion waiver, which provides services for people with disabilities who need the level of care provided in a nursing home. And this is actually the largest of the five waiver programs. In fiscal year 2022, it had about 42,000 annual recipients. The Developmental Disabilities waiver provides services to people who need the level of care in an ICFDD. The Brain Injury waiver provides services with a traumatic or acquired brain injury who needs the level of care provided in a nursing home or a neurobehavioral hospital. And then finally, the Elderly waiver provides services for the elderly who are at risk of nursing home placement. And I should just mention that the Department of Human Services is in the middle of a big initiative called the Waiver Reimagine Initiative, where they are moving to move from four disability waivers to two. The first phase of the phase-in has already been completed, and I believe phase two is supposed to begin on January 1st of 2026.
Members, any question for Ms. Cornelia? I know I have one quick question for Representative Edel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. That's really helpful. And can you tell me more about, and the rest of the committee, about the waiver reimagined? Is that going to be easier? The waiver process can be quite complicated for people. So curious what the objectives and goals are of moving to that system.
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, I think part of it is to make the administration and application process and everything easier for people, and also to provide people with more flexibility in how they direct their services, I believe, is a part of it as well.
Ms. Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the two, the four waivers, what are they going to, how are you breaking them up? What are the two waivers? Who's going to be grouped together for those two waivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, I would have to double check with the Department of Human Services, but my recollection is that one of the waivers is going to be for people who are more independent and able to direct their services and live kind of independently in their own place versus other people who need, I guess, more supports.
We have DHS, but I think they'll come back and do a long-term presentation on the waiver reimagine. I know that's a phase two. We authorized that to happen, so we'll have more deep conversation. I know also we'll be talking about the transition from PCA to CFSS, which is on hold, and so many other things are going on with that area too. So we expect more detail to come from DHS, but also I think when you look at the numbers here. We have less expenditure coming from the state. I believe this is because of the enhanced FMAP, and I think that was touched a little bit by Mr. Brady. I don't know if you wanted to explain that portion of it.
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct, that there's more federal expenditures in recent years because of the enhanced FMAP. And since we're paused here, I have a couple of things I was going to pass around. I know this is a lot of information for us to go through in one day. If anybody is interested in more detail on any of the things that we're going to go through today, we have a lot of information on our website, and you can find things either on our website or we have printed versions of publications. So I'm just going to pass around examples of a couple of the types of things that we have in case anybody's interested, and then move along. So this next slide is similar to one that Mr. Berg went through. This is for state fiscal year 2021, showing MA enrollees and expenditures by category. And my point with this slide is just to show that people who are age 65 or older or have disabilities make up about 15% of enrollees and about 59% of spending in MA. Next, I'm going to transition to the long-term care programs that are state-funded. So some of the primary programs here are long-term care consultation services, which provide screening, assessment, and information and education services to help individuals access and decide on the appropriate level of long-term care services. The Family Support Grant Program provides state cash assistance for maintaining a child with developmental disabilities or a related condition in the family home. And these funds are for those expenses that are incurred as a result of the disability. And the grants are limited to about $3,100 annually per year or per child. The Consumer Support Grant Program is a state-funded program that is an alternative to MA-reimbursed home care, specifically home care services of a home health aide, PCA, or a home care nurse. And eligible participants receive monthly cash grants to replace fee-for-service home care payments under MA and manage and pay for a variety of home and community-based services. And this is another program that will be replaced by the Community First Services and Supports program when that rolls out. Semi-independent living services are provided to adults with a developmental disability or related condition in their home and community to maintain or increase their ability to live in the community. This program is a joint state and county funded program. And each county receives an allocation from the state and then must determine how to distribute that allocation among eligible clients. And then finally, Essential Community Support Services was created to provide support services to people who are no longer eligible for nursing facility services or certain waiver services due to changes that were made to the nursing facility level of care back in 2015. And this benefit is limited to about $470 per month in services and supports. The next set of services are programs that are administered by the Board on Aging. The Board on Aging is a 25-member board whose members are appointed by the governor. The staff are provided by the Department of Human Services, and the board is housed within DHS. And one of the primary functions of this board is to administer federal Older Americans Act funding. And some of the programs that are administered through the Board on Aging are the Senior Linkage Line, which is a free telephone service that provides elderly persons with information on and assistance in accessing a range of community services, accessing prescription drugs, and also provides health care counseling. The Minnesota Help provides individuals with information and guidance on long-term care planning, decision-making, and resources. And it's a website where people can access a directory of long-term care, health care, housing, disability and human services providers and organizations. Next is senior nutrition services, which are actually a couple different services. There are senior dining services and then also home delivered meals. Caregiver grants are grants that are provided to the local area agencies on aging and also service providers to fund respite care, education and training in caregiving, and support groups for family caregivers. Dementia grants are competitive grants that are awarded by the Board on Aging to increase awareness of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, to promote the benefits of early diagnosis, increase the rate of cognitive testing, and connect caregivers to education and resources. Minnesota Senior Corps is a network of programs that provide elderly persons with volunteer opportunities. And then finally, the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care is an office that serves as an advocate for and investigates and resolves complaints concerning the health, safety, welfare, and rights for people receiving long-term care services. And then the final slide for long-term...
There's a question, Ms. Pignan. Go ahead, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Chair. I just had a quick question about the 25-member board. Can you tell me what the geographic spread of that as a member from Greater Minnesota? I am just trying to make sure that boards that are making these big of decisions are inclusive of all areas of Minnesota. Do you know what the geographic spread is?
Ms. Pune.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keeler, I don't off the top of my head know how the membership is distributed.
Representative Keeler.
Be really interesting if we could follow up with that to see. I think moving forward in general, Greater Minnesota gets overlooked and our voices as important. So if somebody could get that over to me, that would be ideal. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a little unfamiliar with the Minnesota Health when I was looking at this list, but I see it refers, if you look up Minnesota Health, you get senior linkage line. So are they all interconnected? This looks like it's offering snow shoveling and that kind of removal, but I just hadn't been aware of Minnesota Health as, you know, senior linkage line is pretty good.
Ms. Pignan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keel, I think there is coordination among all of those things.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Please proceed, Ms. Pignan.
Mr. Chair, members, the final slide for long-term care relates to Minnesota Department of Health activities in long-term care. The health department administers programs related to long-term care primarily around the regulation of facilities and providers. MDH licenses facilities that provide long-term care services, including nursing homes and boarding care homes. Surveys nursing homes under a cooperative agreement with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Licenses assisted living facilities. Approves exceptions in certain circumstances to the moratorium on licensure of new nursing home beds. Licenses home care providers. And also operates the Office of Health Facility Complaints, which investigates complaints received regarding facility violations of state or federal law, including maltreatment reports. And then the health department also administers a couple of programs to help long-term care providers attract and retain employees, including the Home and Community-Based Services Employee Scholarship Program and the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program. And during the pandemic, the Department of Health was also active with initiatives to prevent or address COVID-19 in long-term care facilities. And next, Ms. Sunderman will talk about behavioral health.
Ms. Sandup, welcome to the committee. There's a question from Representative
Bick. Mr. Chair, thank you. I think this is more of a statement, I think, for the committee members here. When we wrapped up the Minnesota Department of Health long-term care activities, we all know the role that the Department of Health plays in those committee, in our long-term nursing homes. I just really want to make sure that we as a committee really dive into the seriousness of what we're hearing in our local homes, long-term care facilities, and the immense pressure of the surveyors, and when they show up, usually unannounced for obvious reasons, but it is a real problematic issue right now because the Department of Health is not consistently, I think, delivering those services and advice and how to manage our staffing. And when they report a self-mistake, it becomes so problematic, and so much money is being penalized by these homes to the going to the state of Minnesota. It's an area of great concern all over the state of Minnesota. So I just hope that both these committees really focus in on the issue of how can we assist, how can we bring those back. It's causing tremendous pressure on workforce in our nursing homes. So I just wanted to make a statement, I guess, Mr. Chair, to make sure that's a big priority for us this year. Thank you.
Representative Beck, that has been noted. The Human Department of Health is here, so we're hoping that they'll come back to the committee. Any other question from members or comment? See none. Ms. Sanderman, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Sarah Sunderman from Nonpartisan House Research. I'll start by talking about behavioral health and then more specifically substance use disorder treatment services. There are three sort of main steps in the process of SUD treatment. It starts with assessment, which is an evaluation of a person's substance use and SUD treatment needs and placement. Assessment involves diagnostic testing, a review of medical, legal, mental health, and treatment records, a physical screening, assessment of need for withdrawal management services, and interviews with other people in the person's life. Then moving to treatment, the main types of treatment are detox and withdrawal management services, residential and non-residential treatment services, and SUD treatment providers are licensed by DHS under the requirements of chapters 245A and 245G primarily. Then there are sober homes for sort of aftercare services, although actually they don't provide any treatment services, so sober homes are typically authorized and regulated on the local level through zoning regulations and that sort of thing because they don't provide treatment services, so they're not licensed currently by DHS. And then there are extended care services. And then there are recovery community organizations, peer-based recovery support services, and service coordination services. So within SUD treatment, counties and tribes are responsible for determining financial eligibility for publicly funded SUD treatment, for coordinating placement in treatment services for clients enrolled in managed care organizations, and for paying the state a percentage of the cost of services for individuals who are not enrolled in MA. Publicly funded SUD treatment services are is provided via either managed care, which is MA, Minnesota Care, or a prepaid medical plan, or through the Behavioral Health Fund. This was formerly known as the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, or CCDTF. Behavioral Health Fund recipients must be enrolled in public health care programs or meet income and household guidelines and have insufficient insurance coverage. And of course, recipients must also meet clinical requirements to receive Behavioral Health Fund treatment funding. Moving quickly to mental health, in general, counties are responsible for providing publicly provided mental health services for children and adults. This may be the county providing services directly or contracting with private entities to provide services or, and referring individuals to community resources. Programs and services must comply with the Children's Mental Health Act, the Adult Mental Health Act, Minnesota Statutes Chapter 245I, and other statutory standards for MA eligible services and relevant administrative rules. Funding comes from federal, state, and county sources for mental health services. A very large chunk of this is MA funding, but there are grants such as adult mental health grants and children's mental health grants, and then some other smaller grant programs within that as well. Public health care programs and private insurance pay for some mental health services as well. This graphic sort of takes you through the process of the components of mental health service delivery. Starts with assessment. This includes diagnostic assessments, which are required for every publicly funded mental health service. But within that, there are also functional assessments and level of care assessments and crisis assessments for different services and different circumstances. Then there's the development of an individual treatment plan and community support planning. Then the delivery of mental health services, which we'll get into next, and reassessment and continued evaluation for the need for mental health services. getting into the types of mental health services, the first sort of group of services is crisis and emergency services. We have the, and for all of these services that I'm going to talk about, DHS's website has a lot more detail on each program, as well as the provider manual for the MA-eligible services. So crisis and emergency services include the suicide and crisis lifeline number 988. There's also mobile crisis response and intervention services and residential crisis response and stabilization services. Residential services are sort of for the most acute care, and these are short-term inpatient hospital treatment, a set of services called intensive residential treatment services, or IRTs, and there are also there's also state-operated treatment facilities such as Anoka, which I'll also get into later in the presentation. And we have community-based or non-residential or outpatient community residential mental health services. So this includes assertive community treatment, or ACT, adult rehabilitative mental health services, ARMS, targeted case management, partial hospitalization, adult day treatment, intensive outpatient treatment, certified community behavioral health clinic services, and behavioral health home services. And each of these services I've talked about has eligibility criteria, and some of them can overlap or be provided concurrently. This is a graphic from the DHS website that sort of illustrates the intensity of services that I talked about. Moving to children's mental health services. This is also from the DHS website, and it sort of shows the parallel tracks of services. The children's mental health service continuum largely follows that for adults, but there are some additional specialized programs for children, such as Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, CTSS, Intensive Treatment and Foster Care, Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facilities, Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, and school-linked mental health services. Moving next to direct care and treatment services. These are state-operated, so operated by DHS, healthcare services for individuals with complex needs related to mental illness, substance use disorder, developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injury, and those committed as mentally ill and dangerous. This might be kind of hard to see, but it's a map from the DHS website that shows the location statewide of the range of direct care and treatment services and sites. So the direct care and treatment services include services for adult mental health. These are at community behavioral health hospitals or the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and within the Minnesota Specialty Health System. Child and adolescent behavioral health services. There are community-based and residential services in Willmar. And also there's the MITH, the Minnesota Intensive Therapeutic Homes program. And there's also community addiction recovery enterprise, their community support services, rehabilitation services, special care dental clinics, and forensic services, which include the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, Minnesota Security Hospital, the Forensic Nursing Home, Transition Services, and the Competency Restoration Program. And I'm not going to get into the details of all these services, but there is a publication on our website that gets into some more detail on the direct care and treatment services available. To talk briefly about the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, this is a court-ordered treatment program for individuals who are civilly committed by the court as sexually dangerous persons or as having a sexual psychopathic personality. There are two sites, Moose Lake and St. Peter. It's my understanding that quite often, typically, an individual begins treatment at Moose Lake and transfers to St. Peter if they progress in the treatment process. St. Peter has both a secure perimeter and a community preparation services area. As of October 1st of 2022, there were 741 individuals receiving treatment in Moose Lake and St. Peter. And then provisional discharge from this program can be granted by the Special Review Board and the Supreme Court Appeal Panel. And again, as of October 1st, 2022, 75 people had been granted provisional discharge in supervised community placements. 42 individuals were living in the community and with, I believe, under 10 people awaiting placement. And there have been 17 full discharges. I'll talk briefly about programs for people experiencing homelessness. So one of these programs is emergency services grants, and these grants provide homeless persons with essential services and emergency shelter, and these grants are awarded on a competitive basis. Transitional housing, which provides housing for a homeless person or family at a rental rate of 25% of a family's income for a period of up to 36 months. This may also include up to 6 months of follow-up support services for persons who complete transitional housing as they transition to, as they stabilize in sort of permanent housing. The Homeless Youth Act provides street outreach, drop-in programs, emergency shelter programs, and integrated supportive housing and transitional living programs for homeless youth and youth at risk of homelessness. And this is this program provides services for people up to 24 years of age. And then long-term homeless supportive services provides integrated services to stabilize individuals, families, and youth living in supportive housing. This is for individuals who have lacked a permanent place to live continuously for 1 year or more, or at least four times in the past 3 years. Switching now to services for vulnerable adults. So a vulnerable adult under statute is an individual who is 18 years of age or older, who is impaired physically, mentally, or emotionally, and unable to protect themselves from maltreatment, resident or inpatient of a facility, and individuals who receive certain outpatient services or home care services. In section 626.5572, is where the definition of maltreatment is for vulnerable adults. And maltreatment is abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. And all of these terms are further defined in that section. Certain people are required to report suspected maltreatment. These are mandated reporters. But any person may voluntarily report suspected maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. Reports of suspected maltreatment must be made to the common entry point, which is the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, or MARC, which must be available 24 hours a day to accept reports. Facilities that are federally certified health facilities must also report to MDH's Office of Health Facility Complaints.
There's a question from Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if you can just talk to us a little bit more about the services for vulnerable adults and how eligibility is determined for those services.
Ms. Sandel.
Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, I believe eligibility is really, it comes up after there's a report of maltreatment and whether that report is screened in or if it's screened out, but there might be some lingering concerns that the county has, even if the allegations don't amount to maltreatment, then the county can provide services. It's typically based on a maltreatment report, whether it's screened in or screened out.
Representative Zelenska.
Thank you. I just had a question. Thank you for being here. I was on the number that you gave for the vulnerable adult, I think it was 7,000 for investigations. I'm wondering what the number is that is for senior centers, long-term care, nursing homes, home care versus children.
Ms. Sandoval.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, which slide are you referring to?
Let me just see.
Representative.
Was this one of the finance?
No, it's. Let me just see here. I'll find it in a second. I had it. It's on this that you just gave us. I just got to find the page.
I think on the maltreatment report, there was a report that was issued recently that covers most of the issue of vulnerable adults maltreatment and the number of cases that are screened in, screened out, and how mm-hmm. that, I think that may be the reference too. So I think okay. DHS, if they're able to share that information from that report, that'll be great. Representative Zelensky.
Yeah, it's on page 42 of the handout that you gave us. It's 7,683 maltreatment reports received.
We're not there yet, so we're okay. moving slowly.
We'll get there. Ahead.
Ms. Sandoval, I think you can proceed. We'll reach page 42.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. We'll get there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So reports are screened and referred to the appropriate lead investigative agency within 2 working days after it's received. A report is received by MARC. Counties, law enforcement, DHS, and MDH assess and investigate allegations of maltreatment within statutory timelines, and the counties provide protective services when needed. So House Research, we have a fairly large publication on the Minnesota Vulnerable Adults Act, which has a lot more detail about sort of the path that maltreatment reports take and the various responses and required timelines that can happen. So now I'm going to talk about some of the provider fraud, the program integrity and operations activities within DHS and state statute. So there are provider fraud prevention mm-hmm. programs. The DHS Office of Inspector General, or OIG, oversees fraud prevention and recovery efforts for DHS-administered public programs. DHS procedures and initiatives aim to reduce provider fraud and improper payments. And they do this through various means, educating providers, recommending system edits to prevent improper claim payment, conducting provider screening visits, operating a surveillance and integrity review section to investigate MA provider and recipient fraud, and by requiring PCA agencies to develop and implement policies and procedures to verify service. DHS also contracts with outside entities to conduct post-payment provider audits and to identify and recover overpayments and identify underpayments. For recipient fraud prevention, one of the main programs is the Minnesota Restricted Recipient Program, where recipients are placed in a program after reviews show abuse or misuse of medical services. In this program, recipients are restricted to one primary care provider, clinic, hospital, and pharmacy for 24 or 36 months to reduce costs. There's also a county-administered program called the Integrity Reinvestment Project, which pays for preventing and investigating fraud in the state's cash assistance, child care, health care, and food programs. And in general, the fraud prevention programs prevent and reduce improper payments by resolving eligibility questions for caseworkers. This slide gives some details on some of the results of the fraud prevention programs. It's not the most updated data, but I can work with DHS to get more updated numbers if anyone on the committee desires that. Another aspect in program integrity and operations is DHS program regulation. A big part of this is licensing. DHS issues licenses or certifications for approximately 20,000 programs and providers at any given time, give or take 1,000 or 2,000. Certain licensing functions are delegated to counties. This would be family child care, family child foster care, adult foster care mainly. Those are processed by counties, and those programs are generally more closely monitored by the counties within statutory requirements. Some private agencies can perform licensing functions related to child placement and child foster care. And DHS directly licenses or monitors all other programs and issues correction orders and other licensing actions for violations. This includes child care centers, children's residential facilities, mental health treatment programs, substance use disorder treatment and detox programs, home and community-based services, child placing agencies, and the sex offender program.
Ms. Sandovan, I think there are two members with questions. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Quick question. Is it possible that you don't have updated information on your fraud integrity, like the operations, because state employees were not allowed to go in to the homes, you know, to assess the situations, or that people were not allowed to go into homes during the shutdowns, during that period, that two-year period?
Ms. Sandovan.
Mr. Chair, members, that would be a question more directly for DHS. Just because I don't have access to the information doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So I assume someone from DHS can follow up, but those are the most recent numbers I have. So I can't speak for DHS necessarily on whether they have the data or not.
We'll have DHS on Thursday, so hopefully that question can be answered.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gill. Representative Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just wanted to point out, I know there was a question earlier about the breakdown of allegations of or reports of maltreatment. And I just wanted to point folks to, again, the Minnesota Department of Human Services website does a really good job of breaking that down for us. And they have a dashboard. And I can share a quick, these numbers are off by 2 months. So the posted numbers on the website are December 21 to November 22. Just to give you an idea of how these work out, the total number of maltreatment reports for minors were 553. The total number of maltreatment reports for adults were 7,177.
Thank you so much. That's how I think the information is easily accessible from the department, but we'll keep on following that up with his information. Yep. So, yeah, it's actually on the screen now. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, chairs, and thank you so much for coming. I just have a quick follow-up question. You said around the licensing. In an earlier slide, you talked about sober homes not being licensed and just having jurisdiction on the local level. And I know there are other programs that don't have licensure as well. There's maybe certification or maybe just enrolled through like provider enrollment or another local mechanism. Do we have any data about how those investigations are collected and administered? Do we know that information?
Ms. Senator.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, that is a good question. I think if they're not regulated by DHS in any way, I think that would be quite difficult to gather the data. And I think for the sober homes, some of these providers, there are sort of provider associations that might have at least some portion of the data, but otherwise, I don't know.
So I just want to clarify. So if the program is not licensed by DHS or Health, sounds like, then there is no formal mechanism for kind of monitoring those concerns.
Ms. Sen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks? No question.
Very interesting.
Representative Edels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, Representative Hicks, I just wanted to make you aware. I've been working on sober home legislation for 3 years now, so hopefully this year will be the year that we will pass it. But some of the complaints are going through MASH. We do have a sober home association here, but NAMI is getting some of the complaints, counties are getting some of the complaints. It's really piecemeal, and so hopefully we'll have a lot of support in this committee.
Thank you so much, Representative Edelson. No further questions. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on this slide, talking about investigations, DHS receives and investigates allegations of maltreatment of children and vulnerable adults served by licensed programs or providers. As was previously discussed, there's a lot of data online on the DHS maltreatment report and investigation dashboard. So I captured the data for between October 2021 and September 2022, that there were 7,683 reports of maltreatment received. And for this presentation, I didn't break it down, but as was pointed out, the dashboard has a lot of detail on the allegations and maltreatment reports received. 8% of reports were assigned for investigation. Maltreatment was substantiated in 29% of those investigated. And DHS also investigates alleged licensing violations and takes licensing action based on the results of those investigations.
We'll start with the lead. Sorry, I see so many questions. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit about you said 8% of reports are assigned for investigation and maltreatment is substantiated in just under 30% of those investigated. Can you just tell us a little bit about, and maybe this is really a question for DHS, I apologize, but what is the process for that? 8% seems like a low number, but maybe it's just because people report everything under the sun, which doesn't really qualify.
Ms. Sandoval.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, there are lots of reasons. So a maltreatment report has to have enough identifying information, for example, and sometimes the report either doesn't have that or doesn't have, or the allegations don't meet the level of maltreatment, and so that kind of report would be screened out. There are also, this includes reports of child maltreatment that wouldn't be referred for investigation but would be referred for family assessment as an alternative path that is, that's, you know, mainly just to provide services and to keep the child in the home. So there are various reasons why it seems like a low number screened in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Maybe it was the same question. Representative Zelenska.
Thank you. My question is on this reporting, the minors are a lot less, the children, than the adults, like I suspected. I'm wondering if, and I'll look at the DHS report for the years, but I'm curious to see the numbers that were before COVID and then during the COVID time. I know that the definition on page 36 of maltreatment in nursing homes and home and community-based services is abuse and neglect. And having been a nursing home administrator, we self-report, as do many. Mm-hmm. So an example can be if a care plan's not followed, you are self-reporting a report to the agency. The Office of Facility Health complaints could come in during the COVID years. I'm curious to see the number of violations and then the fines that have went to facilities at a time when we had no staff and we knew it. And we are reporting across the state. So we penalized nursing homes and assisted living settings really for no fault of their own. And we had surveyors come in, and I'm hearing from nursing home administrators, nursing assistants, people are being disciplined as a disciplinary action because the surveyors are finding a violation. Two-person transfer is not done. One person does it. Care plan's not followed. It's a violation. And so I have great concern for our industry of what we're doing for seniors because without caregivers, we can't give care. So we are possibly disciplining people for no fault of their own. And so I'd like to see it. I'm going to look at that data. I don't know if it's on DHS for the amount that facilities have been fined for licensed facilities for nursing homes, home and community-based services from the pandemic years versus prior and what those numbers are for OHFC violations because it wouldn't be surprising to me that the volume went up higher. And I think we have an obligation to look at the fact that we're coming out of a pandemic. And if we're going to stabilize nursing homes and assisted livings, finding them when we have created the parameters in large respect is probably a negative outcome in every community we have.
That's a great question. So I know DHS will be the best entity to respond to that question. But if you wanted to respond, Ms. Sandman, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know whether DHS or MDH even might be the best entity to answer this question, but I do know on the dashboard there is you can get data, and in the most recent update of our vulnerable adults publication, we have some sort of charts on the number of reports received. We don't have information on the fines for licensing violations in there, because it's just the maltreatment side of things. So on the dashboard, you can find the number of complaints and all of that, but I don't believe that dashboard has information about the penalties that were levied.
Representative Hugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would remind members, too, this has been a huge conversation a few years ago. Data was not being handled right away. So while it takes up to 2 days, it may not be more than a few hours, depending on what the maltreatment is. And I think as Representative Zelenikar, I'm going to massacre her name, pointed out that the nursing homes are having, facilities are having real challenges. Their staff are walking away. I happen to know that at one point there was an inspection done, and the nurse at the time was trying her hardest to get what she needed done, not fast enough for the inspector, and she ended up quitting. And this isn't unusual. She just said, I can't handle this anymore, because she not only was being accused of mistreating the resident that she cared about, but she was possibly going to be fined. Now, do we need to make sure our seniors, our people that are in residence, are taken care of?
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to maybe take a step back from the horrendous stories we heard years ago, not years ago, just 4 years ago, about how awful people were being treated. And we need to really look at it as a team effort between DHS, our nursing homes, our facilities, and understand what's going on. And the other thing that I would remind you, having cared for a lot of senior citizens, they're not two-year-olds. You cannot pick them up and say, you will not do X, Y, Z. And they do things. My grandmother had a purple, and I mean a black purple hand one day. And I walked in and I said to the nurse, what's going on? And she didn't want to tell me. This is 30 years ago. And finally I got the aide to tell me what had happened. My grandmother had grabbed a possession of someone else's. They wanted it back. They couldn't get her to let go of it, so they bit her, and bit her hard. I'm amazed they didn't break something. But at any rate, she was fine, and it's unfortunate, but I knew that. I knew she packed people all the time. She'd go in their rooms and pack their stuff. It was long before memory care. But anyway, that is the importance of this reporting. I'm glad we're hearing about it, and as someone else pointed out, you can look that up. The department will send it to you. I get the reports all the time. I can see what's going on in my district, what's going on with my nursing homes or facilities in general. And it's a great reporting system, but it isn't without its challenges too. And unsubstantiated does not mean that nothing happened. It just means it was unsubstantiated. So substantiated is just a part of the discussion. But thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me explain that.
Thank you so much, Representative Hill. So we're back to Ms. Sandman, if you will finish the remaining slides, please.
All right, the last topic I'm going to talk about is background studies. DHS conducts background studies on all individuals who provide direct contact services to children and or vulnerable adults in licensed programs. Direct contact means face-to-face care, training, supervision, counseling, consultation, or medication assistance to clients in Health and Human Services programs.
DHS also conducts background studies for programs licensed by MDH and the Department of Corrections. These background studies are also required for others such as guardians and conservators, foster care providers, people seeking adoption, and people over the age of 13 living in the household where a licensed program is located.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have, and maybe you'll get to this on this next slide, but I had heard, so I was a foster parent, I'm an adoptive parent, and I'm in touch with foster and adoptive parents across the state, a number of them actually in Representative Baker's district, as it happens. We sit next to each other today. But I had heard from a number of people about the struggle to get fingerprints and background screens done and completed throughout the time frame of COVID and when different offices across the state were shut down. Do you have any background information? I mean, has the backlog kind of, has that been taken care of? Or are we still seeing high waiting times or folks who are, you know, that process has been delayed? And, you know, it's a concern to me as a parent for, you know, children who are potentially have found their adoptive family, but we're just waiting on the approvals to go through because of the fingerprints and all of this sort of stuff. And Representative Edelson is also mentioning hospitals. And doctors and nurses who need fingerprints done for their background screens and those sorts of things. So just hoping you could address that.
I think DHS is here. I know there's so many questions, but Mr. Buddick, if you wanted to introduce yourself and proceed with your response.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services, and thank you, Representative, for the question. Yes, fingerprint background studies were a real struggle during the COVID-19 pandemic. As folks who have been around for a few years will remember, during the height of the pandemic, we actually had to stop doing fingerprint background studies and had to waive the rules to just go to a name and date of birth background study. Recently, and with the partnership of the legislature, we've been transitioning back to full fingerprint background studies for all individuals. And there's been quite a bit of demand as people that didn't have a fingerprint background study during that period of time need to go back through that process. To further complicate things, we actually switched fingerprint vendors during this time because we re-procure our contracts every 5 years according to state law. I am happy to report that we are monitoring on a weekly basis the capacity at our fingerprint sites. The most recent update that I got just this week showed only two sites operating above 85% capacity, which is sort of our threshold in terms of appointments available. And actually, the overall statewide capacity has actually returned to a much more normal level. So we are feeling good that this system is starting to right itself. That said, we do have surges of demand in different areas as different workforce challenges come up. And so as you hear about those, please do bring those to our attention. The other place where there can be challenges is we've got a very complicated background study system here in Minnesota, and there's actually a task force that recently convened by the legislature that I would encourage people to take a look at those recommendations. For 85% approximately of people, we clear very quickly. It goes through the system, it checks the databases, it says you're either in or you're out. When something flags in our system, that's where delays occur. For instance, if we need information from another state, we can't compel the state of Alabama, for instance, to get us the records we need. And it might involve actually an attorney manually looking at our laws versus another state's laws. So there's just a few examples where, in certain circumstances, a background study can take a considerable amount of time to clear. And we understand the, you know, issues that creates for providers during a workforce shortage when you're trying to get people on. So very excited to have a lot of conversation with you all this year about background studies, an issue that gets very complicated very quickly, but really important to kind of the integrity of our system.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. If you would be able to share the information with the committee on the new fingerprint vendor, just out of curiosity.
Mr.
Either now or later. Thank you.
Be happy to follow up.
Representative Jones, do you have any questions?
I do. Thank you, Chair. Kind of back to this vendor question. So it comes up both in our nursing and in child care as well. In Moorhead, where I'm at, I'm under the impression from my community and constituents that our fingerprint licensing location is actually closed. And like Fargo's our sister community, and so we can't go there. So we're sending people, I think, to maybe Fergus Falls or Pelican is even the closest, which is impacting our economic opportunities. And so not only to follow up with who that vendor is, but where are their locations and what's their time frames? Because when we're working with a population that needs to come in to get fingerprinted during the time that they're supposed to be at work, you know, they close at 4 p.m., there's not really a whole lot of, like, user-friendly timing, because we're going through extreme shortages, and this tends to be one of the barriers. So I'd really like to follow up and get some information on the accessibility and the timing and geographic opportunity for all of that.
Mr. Berg, did you want to respond to that quickly?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Happy to follow up on that specific situation. I will say we do have stipulations in our contract for the vendor that manages globally that we need to have sites within 35 miles of everyone in Minnesota. But I also recognize that communities, when a site closes, that creates a real strain. And so I want to dig into the specifics in your community and bring in our Inspector General to talk to you more in depth. Thank you.
Representative Zelensky.
Thank you for your last comment, because that was going to be my question, is backup plans, because 35 miles doesn't seem like a long way, but when you're hiring entry-level positions and you're driving through winter, 35 miles is a long way in northern Minnesota. So I have parents concerned that their kids are driving. I've had that question. So I wondered if you could give us all a map of where they are. Otherwise, direct us where we can find it, if it's just on DS, which link it would be to. But I think that's a barrier to getting timely hiring. And we have winter, more months than we care to have sometimes. So thank you.
No, I promise we'll have a whole day of discussing about background studies. So I think there'll be more conversation.
Looking forward to it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. As we proceed, I think we've got one more last slide that covers some of this discussion that we just had.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As discussed, NET Study 2.0 is the HHS background study system, requires fingerprint and photographs unless they were emergency background studies, and we went into that discussion. It searches a wide range of records, records from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the Minnesota Court Information System, National Crime Information Database, FBI records in specified circumstances, records of substantiated maltreatment, professional licensing records, and predatory offender registries. The system also provides electronic updates of the study subject's criminal records and electronic employer notifications. The list of disqualifying conduct and crimes is in Minnesota Statutes Section 245C.15, and Chapter 245C is the chapter with all of the background study requirements. And just to give you an idea, in calendar year 2020, DHS received 429,284 background study applications with about 2% disqualified. As mentioned, also, the Background Studies Task Force just ended and issued a report with a lot of recommendations and alternative recommendations regarding disqualifying crimes and a lot of other details related to the background studies process. And I believe that ends the presentation.
Do you have anything to add, Ms. Nguyen?
Mr. Chair, members, I have an answer for Representative Keeler's question related to the Board on Aging.
Please.
The statute that governs the Board on Aging requires that the governor appoint at least one member from each congressional district, and the remaining members shall be appointed at large.
Good to know. Now we can discuss. Representative Keeler, do you want to have the last word on that?
Thank you. I guess a follow-up question is there any spots on that are held for tribal nations or tribal representation? I did see that there's a couple chairwomen on the aging committee. I'm just wondering if in statute it's actually designated that there are spots held for tribal representation.
Ms. Pugnan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Keeler, I don't think there's a specific requirement for that. There's sort of a general requirement that the governor shall give consideration to individuals having a special interest in aging and include people affiliated with agriculture, labor, industry, education, social work, health, housing, religion, recreation, and voluntary citizen groups.
So no. Thank you.
We'll work on it. So, thank you. Any other member questions? Just wanted to thank the nonpartisan staff for their great work, Ms. Pinelli, Ms. Sanderman, Mr. Burke, Mr. Haney. Thank you so much for the presentation. This is a lot to digest. We have enough time to read and go through some of this process. Please feel free to reach out to them if you have any questions. Lee, New Berkeley, any statement or anything? Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I want to say thank you for the opportunity for having our committee be able to be part of this. I know there's a lot that we have to process, and this gives us a chance to try to get some of that information earlier. Lead Keel, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lead Keel, so for joining us today. As we go back to our regular schedule, we will have on Thursday budget review with the Department of Human Services staff. So looking forward to that. No any further agenda items. We're now adjourned.